it all to Night Fright. Tonight, folks, we've got Ted Peters on the line. Just let me tell you a little bit. We're going to be looking at a new book he's got out called UFOs, God's Chariots, about Ted Peters. Ted Peters is an author, professor, and pastor. He is research professor emeritus in systematic theology and ethics at Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary, the Center for Theology and Natural Science, and the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, California, where he's calling us from tonight. He offers a theological analysis of culture, analyzing especially the role of science in culture. He co-edits the journal. Ted, welcome to the show, my friend.
Brent, I am glad to be here. Night Fright.
Don't be scared.
How frightened am I going to get?
I'm quivering with anticipation as we speak, my friend. Listen, first of all, tell me the weather in California. How are things in California?
It's 72 and sunny. It's such a burden. Tell me how it is there where you are. Is it good UFO weather, do you think?
It's minus 20 here. There's snow falling, and we're in the Great White North, eh, folks? So what can we say? I'm kidding. It's same weather
yes.
as you. Actually, I Skyped my nephew. He's at Berkeley last week, and he was freezing his tuchus off. Ted. He said it was down in the high 50s, low 60s.
Well, what happens is that this cold fog blows through the Golden Gate Bridge, and it lands right there in Berkeley. And so you can have 80-degree weather 10 miles north or south, but in Berkeley, we freeze our bippies.
No kidding. No kidding. So you got to come to Canada when that happens, and you'll warm up.
Yeah, I think so. And undoubtedly, the flowers are blooming, and the birds are singing.
Pterodactyls are flying. That type of thing. Let's go, Ted. UFOs, God's chariots. Big question mark there. Why the question mark, my friend?
Well, I want to respond, at least in part, to the ancient astronaut theorists who would like to suggest that what we find in ancient scripture and in ancient archaeology is really mistaken UFO visitation. So are UFOs God's chariots in that sense of the word is one question. But then I've got a second one in terms of the contemporary UFO experience, where so frequently visitors from outer space will have a message, and that message usually has to do with putting away the testing of nuclear arms, to put away weapons of mass destruction, to stop destroying our planet. And if we get such messages, I don't care who delivers them, they sound to me like they come from God. So I might give a qualified no on the first one, but an unmitigated yes on the second.
It's okay to have these messages. It's just to get the folks in power that can actually implement them, and I think this has been our struggle all along. Never before, as you probably know, Ted, have we had the ability not only to feed the world, but we've had those distribution channels set in place through all the armed forces throughout the world that we could get that food to the people who need it. Yet we lack, as a species, I'm not just blaming one country here, folks, but as a species, we lack the political will to do it.
Can you imagine if the giant U.S. military were to feed the hungry and bind up the broken and try to protect various peoples from violence? Can you imagine the amount of good our military could do? But, you know, one of the problems would be is that those who are profiting off this don't find that to be in their financial best interest. So one of the difficulties that UFOnauts visiting us from extraterrestrial realms seem to find is just what you said. We lack the political will, and we wonder if the politicians can't really preserve global peace, could some other institution do it. Well, how about the scientists? The scientists are international and multicultural. Could they do it? And so we want to fish around and think that maybe science could save us from what politics cannot save us. But then, you know, scientists have blood on their hands as well. So
I was going to ask you, has there been a precedent from science to do precisely that? I know when the nuclear testing was going on, there was hundreds of scientists that signed that piece of paper to discount any further testing on nuclear weapons. It didn't seem to do any good. The Hiroshima bomb went off irregardless.
I believe that is an important chapter in our history that you bring up there, and I have a little bit of it in the book as I try to explain what was going on culturally in the early 1950s. And what you have just alluded to is Robert Oppenheimer, who's kind of the father of the bomb, second only to Albert Einstein in his fame as a physicist. In 1947, he had proposed to President Truman that we internationalize all the science having to do with atomic weaponry, because he feared that if we didn't and Russia would get the bomb, we would end up with what's called a Cold War. Well, Harry Truman kicked Oppenheimer out of his office, told one of his aides never to let that sniveling scientist back into his office again, and the United States rejected the internationalization proposal. By 1949, the Russians had the bomb, and we were off then to the history that we now have. And I think that tension between political narrow-mindedness and blindness on the one hand and what appeared to be scientific magnanimity and openness and global consciousness, they were in tension with one another. And what I see in the early UFO phenomenon, certainly by 1950, maybe by 1947, is the pitting of science against politics, and it is science that has the potential of saving us, not government.
Interesting perspective you brought up about when the scientists wanted to give that universal declaration, if you will, and allow people to have all the information about nuclear weapons. Does that differ somewhat from what some people advocate in the United States, that every American should be carrying a gun? Is that the same type of, like, drawing a parallel?
I think it's just the opposite.
Okay.
I've heard of another school shooting today, and I know there are some who'd like to arm every first grader with a gun on all the way up and turn our schools into shooting galleries, and somebody would make an awful lot of money on the blood that would get shed. No, I think that the scientific community, for the most part, not completely, but for the most part, really wanted world peace, and there are still many scientists today who really believe that world peace is the way we should be going.
Understood. Now, getting back to your book, and by the way, folks, we're speaking with Ted Peters tonight. You're just joining us. Welcome to Night Fright. Get the coffee going, get the tea going, or get a beverage of your choice going. Kick back and relax for the next 2 hours. We're going to be looking at Ted Peters' new book called UFOs, God's Chariots, with a big question mark at the end. Now, I'm going to ask you, what is, you know, it's sexy and in vogue right now. There's ancient aliens on the television, that show. It's done very, very well. There's lots of shows out there like mine that do UFOs. We cover the UFO thing. Why is it so sexy and in vogue at this particular time in history?
Well, like you, I enjoy watching the History 2 channel, and many of the ancient astronaut documentaries are really quite well done, and they are exciting. I think, regardless of the present moment, people like big ideas. Not everybody, but certainly a large enough percentage of our population. So if you're going to present big ideas, you're going to get an audience. And the ancient astronaut theorists do have really big ideas. I may want to debate whether they are always credible, but they have a scientific cast to them. And I think in our society, one of the invisible religions that we have is the worship of science and technology. And I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing. I don't mean to be suggesting that. But we sometimes ask more from science and technology than what it can deliver. And the ancient astronaut theorists appear to be respecting that respect that we all have, you know, for investigating things carefully and scientifically.
What do you think of some of their results they've come up with? Do you think it's bogus? Do you think there's some credibility behind some of it?
I think that the questions they ask are fair. And in some cases, I even wish that they would be right. However, I
do. Which cases are those, Ted?
Which cases?
Oh, yeah, I think that, just one.
I think it would be great to think that the Nephilim in Genesis chapter 6, the marriage of heaven and earth, might actually have produced a hybrid race. I would like that one to be true. I think there's insufficient evidence for that to be true, but it would be kind of fun to think that we really do have space brothers and sisters and cousins out there. I tend to be more critical of claims that we needed extraterrestrial technology to build pyramids, I think, than to interpret some of those mysterious ancient texts.
You know, there was a big argument several years ago, might be even 10 years ago, that part of that technology, by people just putting it off Earth, if you will, was kind of racist in intent. Do you think there was that intention behind it?
I would not use the word racist. I do know people who respond by saying, wait a minute, they're insulting our ancestors. They're saying our ancestors were too stupid to build those pyramids on their own. And I don't take any umbrage like that, but it does appear to be clear from archaeological and other evidence that our ancestors were pretty smart. And much of what they did in terms of at least architecture was trial and error. If you go to Egypt, you can see the whole history of pyramids there. They started out with small terraced pyramids before they finally got to the big giant ones that we know. So that was normal. It was a normal step-by-step process, not to coin a pun, in order to build a pyramid. So our ancestors were very capable and not stupid.
That's what I feel, too. Now, what always amazes me whenever we discuss the pyramids, because this is something that has intrigued me ever since I was a wee little fella, that the various cultures around the world could build the same type of structures and yet apparently have no connection that we know of between the various cultures. And, of course, I'm thinking of the South American culture, the Central American culture, the Mexican culture, all built pyramids. And, of course, we're looking at the Middle East right now. We're talking about the Giza pyramids. Any speculation into how something like that could occur, a critical mass?
Yes, I do. And there's a large field called the History of Religions. And in the History of Religions field, we know a lot about symbolism and how symbolism worked. And one of the virtually universal natural symbols in the ancient world is the connection between earth and heaven. Mm-hmm. And you're going to get heaven coming down in the form of birds, or you're going to get earth going up in the form of towers, and gravity is such the towers are going to be built with a big bottom and a small top. So there's no mystery at all about what's going on in human consciousness. And if you put the pyramid, which touches heaven and earth, side by side with the shaman, and look at the shaman. The shaman is a figure who has a myth of origin, and in a dream state, the shaman flies to heaven quite frequently on the wings of a hawk or an eagle or whatever happens to be your local bird, and there in heaven learns the esoteric knowledge on how to heal and then comes back to earth, and the shaman almost always has feathers for his or her, you know, kind of shamanic uniform. So it's the connection between heaven and earth that's just built into the human psyche. And to me, that is enough to account not only for pyramids, but why it is that if you want to go on a spiritual retreat, you go to a mountaintop, you know, and the ashrams in India are built on mountaintops and things of that nature. So I find that a reasonable explanation. You don't need contact with extraterrestrials in order to account for pyramids.
Why, though, this insatiable desire to look for something bigger than ourselves? And I'll put that in the big G for God, and I'll put the same category associated. I'll put them all in the same type of category, the same box as ETs. I mean, there's various, apparently there's various, according to some people, various species of ETs. There's the reptilians, there's the Nordic ones, and of course the little grays with the big eyes. Is this all part and parcel of the same thing, or is God in your mind completely different?
At the core of human consciousness, and especially in higher human consciousness, by that I mean first millennium BC, there is built into your and my interior thinking a yearning or a desire to be at one with what is beyond us. And in the ancient world, the thing that was beyond was the sky. You just think of laying on the beach on a sunny day and looking up, and what do you see? Well, you don't see the end of anything. You see virtual infinity. And so the sky in the ancient world, especially if you add the power of the sun or the power of thunder and lightning, the sky was an awesome thing that represented both transcendent power. And most religious myths of the ancient world, especially myths about the origin of the world, included very powerful sky symbolism. Well, we in the modern world, of course, don't believe in gods anymore. So the gods of Olympus all had sky symbolism in ancient Greece, but you can fly over Olympus in an airplane and look down on it. There's no need to believe in the gods anymore, so let's get rid of them. But what happened was a surprise that right behind the sky that we conquered with our airplanes and our weather reports was another sky, and that is outer space. Space does the work today that the sky did 3,000 years ago in just shocking our psyches into a relationship with what is infinite and beyond. And my problem with the ancient astronaut theorists is that on the one hand, they want to connect themselves with what is beyond, but on the other have such a pedestrian understanding of what's transcendent that it's aircraft, nuts and bolts that fly passengers from one planet to another. So they've sort of tapped in to the spiritual resonances of extraterrestrials, but they've failed to see that really what's at work here is the power of transcendence on the human psyche. I hate to say it, but it's a little bit comical because it's kind of like well, at any rate, mistaking your cup of water for the Pacific Ocean or something.
But I'm presuming you don't believe we're alone in this great big universe, or do you?
I believe in God. I like to think about extraterrestrials scientifically. I will have to tell you that empirically, I don't have any evidence that we have space neighbors. But my druthers, my wishes, my hopes, so I hope that they're there, and I hope that they're just as nice as our best experiences reported with UFOs tell us that they are.
Let us hope on that one. Now, when I was in Montreal, I broadcast out of Kingston, but I'm from Montreal originally, and in the eastern townships, there's a cult called the Raelians. And I'm not sure if you've heard of these guys or not, but one of the things I noticed on your website, and a question I have for you, is why numerous cults incorporate UFOs into their worldview, and that's exactly what the Raelians have done. This fellow, Real, says he has been chosen by the aliens. He claims that he's a chosen one of by aliens, and that the aliens will come down and rescue us at one point. That's essentially what he's promoting.
Well, Rael actually provides an excellent paradigm and illustration of most of what I want to say in my book, UFOs, God's Chariots, because the publisher shortened the book on me. I had to eliminate my rather lengthy analysis of Rael and the Raelians, which currently is the largest UFO new religious. But what Rael does with his group, which begins in the mid-1970s, is very much in continuity with the '50s, which arose already in the 1950s. And a look at some of the structures of Raelian belief and practice, and see how they illustrate a secularization and an astral spaceization of classic religious beliefs. So Rael is, he claims, to have been kidnapped or abducted by UFOnauts, and these UFOnauts take him on a Bible study. I just find this absolutely grand. The first thing they do, he has a Bible study. And the UFOnauts explain that we on Earth are a little bit stupid because we think the Bible has a spiritual message when, in fact, it is a message of science and technology delivered by these atheists. Rael's an atheist, and so also are the people who visited from space, atheists, who want to reinterpret everything that we thought was religious in terms of science and technology. So what the space beings do is they deliver to Earth all the goodies, the blessings from heaven, but these blessings are going to be scientific and technology. As we get, you know, the Raelian group is going very well as we get into the 90s now, and genetics is popping up, and paying attention to genetics, and then we get to Dolly the sheep. Well, suddenly the spacelings now are going to provide us with what? The science of genetic engineering so that we can clone human beings. We can clone human beings in such a way that if we take your DNA, Brent, and we create a clone, and then we move your psyche from your old body to your new body, and if we keep doing this in sequence long enough, guess what? Immortality. So now the science and technology from outer space delivers what the Christian religion would have originally delivered, namely resurrection from the dead and immortal life. Well, the list just goes on and on of taking previously religious symbols and religious meanings and religious hopes and translating them into science and technology. And the science and technology on Earth is not good enough, so we have to have an imaginary science and technology in outer space that drops it down here from heaven. Great. It's a vast complex of sublimated religious yearnings recast in scientific jargon, and then it adds the element that we see in cults, just movements, where you have the setter, the axis mundi, or what I call the shaman. In this case, Rael was the shaman, but he's taken up to heaven by a hawk or an eagle. No, it's a flying saucer. But he's a shamanic figure, just like you find in the Native Americans or almost any ancient tribal culture. He's just a shaman in modern dress. So all of this ancient religious symbolism comes roaring back. It's disguised and scientized and technologized, and that would happen with or without UFOs. UFOs is just one way of scientizing a traditional religion, and, you know, there could be others.
Folks, we're speaking with Ted Peters tonight, but very, very interesting subject matter. Stick with us through this. Night Fright Show is the name of the show, www.nightfrightshow.com. Once you go there, just click on tonight's guest book cover. That'll take you right to a spot online where you can order it from the comfort of your own home. And that book is called UFOs, God's Chariots. And we're looking at all aspects of the ancient alien phenomena that, you know, it seems to be so present right everywhere, across the radios right now, across the television. Everybody seems to be looking for something to get away from reality, I would say. And that's what we're looking at tonight. Now, do you think that's caused by 9/11, Ted? That's where I was headed before when I asked.
Oh, I see. About our time.
Yeah.
Earlier times. Let me just say, Brent, I haven't really thought about that. It is true that post-9/11 Western people have higher level of anxiety than we had in the 1990s. We did have that decade from the fall of the Berlin Wall to 9/11, where we didn't really have that much to fear, especially in North America. And is that anxiety back now, 10 years later? Well, let me just say, I don't know. Do I have to have for every one of your good questions?
No, I don't know. I got another good one here, too. Now, you're right. The gospel is telling the story of Jesus with its significance. Now, the task for a postmodern culture is to help it find its significance for them. Now, my question is based on that. What is the essential gospel's significance for you?
Well, when we talk about the gospel of the New Testament, as you just quoted Ted Peters, the first thing about the gospel is it's a story. It's not a philosophy. It's a story about Jesus' life, death, and resurrection. And the significance that is developed in the New Testament is that the resurrection is an anticipation of a new creation that's coming. It's also justification, and it's a fancy word for the forgiveness of sins and a renewed relationship with God. And then it's proclamation. That is to say, it's good news to be shared. Well, we, in our own modern and emerging postmodern era, are just flabbergasted and thrilled with science and technology. I once asked a teenager, what's your summum bonum? What is your highest good? And his answer was a Samsung G5 cell phone. And, that's his highest good in the whole cosmos. The idea that somehow or other we are wedded, our destiny is wedded to science and technology, is sort of, we don't think about it, it's just sort of like tacitly the case. And so these ancient biblical promises, what do they mean for us today? I just see that as an ongoing thought process that we have, and there are going to be a lot of competitors, those who want to have a different story. Not the Jesus story, but a different story in which these things, the great future and somehow or other the meaningfulness of life are all going to come to us, but through science and technology, and God basically is out of a job these days.
God's out of a job. In the Quran, I think it says that there's as many ways to come to God as there is people in the world, which essentially means that everybody has their own path to find God in their own way. Is that part and parcel to what you're trying to say? The future generation will find its own way to defining God in their own sense?
There are two ways to cut that piece of pie. The first way would be, are you and I going to try it? Is the next generation going to try to find God in their own individual way? And the answer is yes. But will they find the true God is a question. And to me, the true God is gracious. That is to say, God has a loving heart and a giving heart. And it's not obvious that God has that gracious quality. Depends on where you look. You can end up with a rather harsh and scolding and vindictive God, and you can even find images of that God in the Bible. You don't have to go that far. But somehow or other, to learn that God is gracious, well, God's going to have to tell us that, because I don't think we're going to find it on our own.
Well, as an extension of that then, Ted, let's go back 2,000 years to the original message from Christ himself. How has that changed in 2,000 years to where we are right now?
I don't think that the core message, the core gospel, I don't think that's different. I think like a doll that we get as a Christmas present, we keep putting different sets of clothes. You know, if you got a Barbie, you're undresser, dresser, and redresser. I think that that's what's going on, but I would liken the gospel of 2,000 years ago to the Barbie and UFOs and all kinds of other ways in which you and I adapt to modern and postmodern culture represent the different clothes that we put on her.
Okay, fair enough. What's that core message, by the way, for you? Can it be defined by a single word, a single sentence, single phrase?
Well, pretty close. You know, the formal definition is the one that you gave a minute ago. The gospel is the telling of the story of Jesus with its significance. The significance is that God loves you and me graciously, that is to say, without strings attached.
Fair enough. Okay, let's talk some more about some of your research. What was some of the anomalies that you found in your research, or some of the anomalies that you brought forward in your book, UFOs, God's Chariots?
Well, the real big one was an apparent change that took place in the late 1980s in the UFO phenomenon. The UFO phenomenon was remarkably stable from 1947 to 1987. And the ideologies that became associated with visitors from space were, for the most part, either neutral, having a kind of scientific cast, or they were benevolent with a much more religious cast. That is to say, these spacelings, who are more advanced than we are in science and technology, have found a way to live in peace, and they are going to come to Earth and help prevent us from destroying ourselves in war, help protect our planet from self-destruction. And it was basically a positive experience. Almost everybody who belonged in the so-called UFO believer camp thought, almost celebrated their image of the UFO-nauts for the most part. Then things changed in the late 1980s and into the 1990s. You have this cabal in New York City. Oh, I didn't mean to say that. A group of authors, Whitley Strieber and Bud Hopkins and David Jacobs, who met frequently, and then once in a while John Mack from Harvard would come down. And the spate of books that started getting published over a 10-year period in there or longer had a very negative picture of the UFO experience. Now people were abused and raped and taken against their will, and we have accounts or stories of impregnations and hybrid babies being born, and individuals, both men and women, but predominantly women, are abducted multiple times, and in some cases aboard the hovering UFO they are going to cradle their hybrid baby, almost to teach those grays, those gray aliens who are wandering around that seem to be so emotionless, teach them how to love a baby. And it's looking now like the spacelings are not going to do us a favor on Earth. No, we are going to help them provide a future in which there will be human emotion and love and care. It's kind of a reverse route of salvation. And I had to say, I don't get this, because this just doesn't look like the UFO phenomenon over the first 40 years. It looks so different. So one of the things I do in the book is I try to take the reader on an investigation to figure out what accounts for this change in the UFO abduction experience.
Was there a single thing that you came across, or was it a multitude of things?
A single thing.
Really?
And now I'm going to give you this hypothesis. I want to hear what you think about it.
Fire away.
And here it goes. I've noticed that you've had Kathleen Marden on, and you've dealt with Betty and Barney Hill abduction case. Am I right about that? Yeah.
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go back to the Betty and Barney Hill abduction case, 1961-62, and included in that in 1965 was the introduction of hypnotic regression. And Dr. Benjamin Simon, the psychiatrist in Boston, used hypnotic regression to retrieve what happened during the missing time. As Kathleen Marden emphasized, Betty and Barney Hill did remember consciously some aspects of it, but the hypnotic regression retrieved certain parts of the story of what took place when Betty and Barney were inside the spacecraft. And out of that, we got the exciting news that they come from a planet orbiting Zeta 2 Reticuli, 29 light years away. And anyway, it's a very exciting case, to be sure. But what I want to flag here is the hypnotic regression. So after 1965, UFO investigators routinely are using hypnotic regression in order to get details of dramatic UFO experiences. Leo Sprinkle, James Harder, a number of UFO researchers are doing this. And then things change in 1980. In 1980, a book is published called Michelle Remembers. And in this case, a psychiatrist, Dr. Pazder, uses hypnotic regression borrowed from the UFO phenomenon now in his setting to retrieve what? Forgotten memories of sexual abuse and satanic ritual abuse.
Well, you must be clairvoyant as well, because I was going to ask you if you felt abductees, if it could be a coping mechanism.
You know, that's a really good point. But I don't think that that was new in 1980. I think that I can't remember if Benjamin Simon had suggested that already in 65, but I think some UFO investigators had suggested that maybe the forgetting of the trauma was a way in which the psychic copes. So that may have predated 1980, but there's no question you're right that from 1980 on, forgetting these terrible experiences is a big part of the phenomenon.
Mm. And it's funny, you know, and I tell this story often whenever we talk about abductees. I guess I could say at best I'm a skeptic. I think these experiences are true for the people that have gone through them. Whether or not it can be faulted to alien abductions, I just don't know. However, I should qualify that by saying I think it's worth investigating. I really do, because people are suffering, and we should get to the bottom of what the suffering is and see if we can alleviate that. Now, I got to tell you this story, though. I think it was Stan Romanek on the show, who's a very famous alien abductee. And I asked Stan, I said, Stan, what did the aliens look like? And he said, well, at what age? Because he'd been constantly being abducted since early age. I said, I don't know, eight years old. He said, okay. He said, the spaceship came down, the door flipped open, and in silhouette out came an alien. And right away I thought, oh, he's watched too many Close Encounters of the Third Kind. You know? And then he said, the alien looked like a fireman. And I thought nothing of it, and I brushed it off.
Yeah.
A few weeks later, a fellow came up to me that never listens to my show, and I don't want to give his – he asked me to be anonymous, so I will do that. And he said, Brent, can I tell you something that happened to me when I was a kid? And I said, sure, go ahead. He said, well, I was outside playing in Barbados. He was from that area, let's put it that way, with my brother. He was 10, I was 8. He said, and my father was inside cooking supper. And all of a sudden, an alien spaceship came down, the door opened, and it walked an alien. And he said, the weird thing was, though, it looked like a fireman. And I thought, oh, my God, what's going on here?
What is going on? Yeah.
So that's why I think it's worth investigating and seeing what's going on and finding out. I have no explanation for it. And if anybody feels that they might want to contribute something, please Skype me at Brent Holland Show, and I'll put you right through to Ted Peters, who's our guest tonight. We're looking at his new book, UFOs, God's Chariots, with a question mark at the end. Easy way, as always, folks, to get any of our guest books, www.nightfrightshow.com, www.nightfrightshow.com. Just click on tonight's guest book cover. That'll take you right to a spot where you can order the book from the comfort of your own home. And this is a good one to get. This is going to challenge you on many different levels and get you thinking. And that's not a bad thing these days, folks, let me tell you. Now, you had mentioned a couple of guests I've had on my show. Another guest I've had on the show is Dr. Francis Collins. And Dr. Francis Collins, folks, you may not be aware if you haven't heard the show, he is the fellow that led the team that broke the genome, and he also wrote a wonderful intro for one of your books. And you were a principal, and I'm going to read this here, principal investigator in a U.S. National Institutes of Health study, Theological and Ethical Questions Raised by the Human Genome and Genetics Determinism. And I'd like to talk about that for a few minutes and some of your findings from that.
Oh, well, great. I appreciate you bringing that up. Yes, I do know Francis Collins, and the book that I wrote was called Playing God on the Question of Genetic Determinism and Human Freedom, and Francis graciously wrote the foreword for that, and volume, actually went through two editions with Routledge, and when we started the research in 1990, when the rocket for the Human Genome Project was taking off, we were looking at religious implications and ethical implications. And at that time, there was a foot, both in the scientific community and in the larger culture, what I call genetic determinism. It's all in the genes. The genome, human genome, was treated almost as if it were sacred. And I hate to say it, but in some ways, the Human Genome Project looks kind of like the UFO project in the sense that you've got something biological that's taking on this this sacred role. One scientist was quoted frequently as saying the human genome is the holy grail of science, the holy grail of science. You wonder, wait a minute, I thought this was science. What do we have holy grails for? and as it turns out, at the end of the genome project, it turns out that your and my genes are important, but they are not almighty. They are not all-powerful in quite the way that the scientists thought they were on the front end.
What did they think they were in the front end? Did they think that we were hardwired a certain way? Is that why?
They did. One of the images that persuaded the U.S. Congress to fund it was the idea that the genome, that's the full collection of genes on your and my DNA, that the genome is the blueprint of what makes us human. Well, as it turns out, that's not the case. But it was a great assumption at the beginning to be looking for the blueprint, and then at the end, by the end I mean somewhere around the year 2001, 2002, it turned out we didn't really have much of a blueprint at all. Oh, yes, genes are important, but you know what? You could violate your genome if you decide to. No, I want to add a story here that maybe you'll appreciate. On the front end, we're talking about 1990 now.
Can you just hang on a second? Ted, yeah, you have a caller on the line. Caller, could you just give your first name, where you're calling from?
David in Montana.
Hi, David.
How are you doing?
Good, man.
Great.
How are you?
I'm enjoying the conversation. I was thinking, you know, like, what if the UFO, the aliens, got the same creator as us? You know, that they're just part of the whole creation.
What do you think, Ted?
Not think that I worry about them taking over, and the only people that do worry about that are people such as Stephen Hawking, who came out, the physicist, came out about a year or so ago saying, don't let them know we're here, we've got to hide because they're going to conquer us. But I don't think he represents the widespread beliefs amongst people in the UFO community, for the most part, who think of the aliens as powerful, but not as ruthless imperialists. It's almost a precious belief that the UFOnauts would have the power to take us over, but they don't have the will. They like us. They love us. If anything,
then why don't
they want to take care of us?
It'd be like watching two-year-olds swinging hammers around. You gotta stop them because they're gonna hurt themselves.
You know, well,
interesting analogy.
Yes, and some of the UFO contactees, they will report that the aliens feel like a big brother or a big sister to us on Earth. That's right, taking away our weapons and trying to get us to play nice with one another. That image actually does come up from time to time. I just want to say that's the dominant image. And being afraid of them, oh, I can see why it's logical. But most people in the UFO world are not afraid of the aliens. If anything, they want to welcome them down and serve them tea.
Ted, was there a concrete time when we went from believing that the ETs were just visiting us or exploring us to where we shifted from that into believing that they created us?
Yes. The idea that they were visiting us for either political reasons or scientific reasons or religious reasons dominated, say, from 1947 into the 1970s. It was in the 1970s that Eric von Däniken gave us the first whiff of the ancient astronaut theory, at least in any major form that has an impact. And as
he wrote, by the way, folks, Chariots of the Gods.
Book Chariots of the Gods, and so I in part chose my title as a response to Eric von Däniken, who I did have a chance to meet, not recently, but some years ago. I think that this idea that you and I are the hybrid children of the ancient astronauts, that's pretty much new in the 1970s. And even though it's a complement to the UFO phenomenon, it's not exactly the same thing.
Okay, fair enough. Now, how do you feel, because you're a theologian, how do you feel about all the references to the Nephilim that we've mentioned before? I was thinking of Jonah. There's actually, you know, when Jonah gets swallowed by the whale, is it possible that cat could be an underwater submarine, or is that possible that it could be an underwater UFO? I've heard people ask me these questions as well.
Right. I tend not to entertain those ideas too seriously. It is the case, getting back to the Nephilim in Genesis 6, that is a mysterious passage, to be sure, and biblical scholars don't necessarily know precisely what that refers to. And as I said before, the marriage of heaven and earth is not an unusual thing to find in ancient literature. With regard to Jonah, I think most scholars think of Jonah actually as a story, as a symbolic story, and not necessarily as history, even though you could imagine there might be some legends running around like that. I was just thinking in the news today, I don't know if you saw this, Brent, where they were tracking this, what, 6 or 8 foot great white shark that got swallowed by something really huge.
Oh my God, really? I haven't heard that.
You know, yes, and they're still trying to figure out what it is that...
That swallowed it. Nobody go in the water till we found out.
That's right. The Jonah story is not impossible. And I guess that the tracking showed that it was a warm body that it was swallowed in, so it wasn't a submarine that wanted to have shark steaks for dinner.
That's incredible. I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Along those same lines, you know, that the mystery plane, the plane that has disappeared, I've heard people say, well, it's like a Bermuda Triangle, that there's vortexes all around the world that things could disappear in. When we say things like that, in your perspective, is that, again, deflecting responsibility off our own selves, saying that we are not in control of our lives and that something bigger is in control?
The idea that something bigger is in control is all the way through the UFO phenomenon, and I also believe the government conspiracy theme also picks up on that. I believe that somebody bigger is in control. I think that's a big part of that. But when it comes to the missing pilots, and you probably noticed how Spielberg handled that in his 1977 movie, The Day the Earth Stood Still, the flying saucer spits them back. And out come the pilots, and they have not aged. Spielberg discovered on doing his research for that movie that there really is sublimated religious sensibilities at work, and that was one of the ways in which Spielberg tried to communicate that, that these pilots were taken temporarily by the spacelings into the equivalent of heaven where they don't age. And now they come back, and they're just as youthful as they were before, which means among the powers of these heavenly beings is eternal life. So I think that's a thought structure. It's an interpretive structure. Do I think there's any factual basis for this? No. I think it's a product of human imagination. Is it impossible? No, it's not impossible. I don't think right now it's plausible.
Fair enough. The music's going to start any second. Folks, we're speaking with Ted Peters, www.nightfrightshow.com. Click on Ted's book cover, UFOs, God's Chariot, with a question mark. That'll get right to a spot where you can order it online from the comfort of your own home. When we come back, and we'll be back in 6 minutes. We're going to be looking at something Ted calls transhumanism, where biology and technology come together to make some kind of hybrid. Stick with us for 6 minutes. Stick around, Ted. We'll be right back in 6 minutes.
All right. Won't be far.
Thank you, my friend. Welcome back, everybody. Welcome to Night Fright. I'm your host, Brent Holland. Great, great guest with us tonight, folks. Ted Peters, he's got a new book out called UFOs, God's Chariots, with a question mark. And we're looking at the possibilities that perhaps there's something more to this UFO phenomenon than just ancient aliens. And it's a very exciting topic for me tonight. I really like this type of topic. We look at things upside down and all around, as I like to say. And no question is unentertained. You can call in anytime, folks. Brent Holland Show via Skype. I'll put you right through to Ted anytime. Get the coffee going. Get the tea going. Get a beverage of your choice going. Join us, folks. We're having a great time tonight. We still have a full hour left. Now, I just want to mention something. There's a fellow who puts my website together. Usually I try to cram his name in at the end because we've run out of time. So tonight I decided to do it after the first break. That fellow's name is Kelly Logue. He lives up in Juneau, Alaska, and he puts my website together, and he helps out with all kinds of stuff to keep this show on the air, and I want to thank him from the bottom of my heart. Thank you, Kelly. You're a great guy, my friend. Let's go back to Ted. Let's look at something that I had mentioned before the break called transhumanism. Can you tell us your definition of transhumanism, Ted?
Well, Brent, I'm glad that you're interested in this topic. It's a rather important one, even though large numbers of people seem to not know anything about it. Transhumanism is a movement. It's been around for a dozen or more years, and at the heart of it are bright young computer scientists and technicians who are like the god Prometheus. They are going to change everything. And as you can tell from the word transhuman, we're talking about a future species that will be post-human in character. And it will be created by us.
Okay, now wait a second. Now, isn't this the exact same scenario that we've just discussed in the previous hour? That, in fact, aliens had come here and created us, and now we are going on and creating a new species?
It sure sounds a lot like it, doesn't it?
Yes. It sure does. So let's get into that, my friend. Let's talk about that and see where we're headed here. Well, how does this evolve?
Yeah, I was going to say, for the most part, even though I hang around with the transhumanists and I hang around a lot with the ufologists,
you know, if you come to Canada, baby, you
can shall meet.
I'll tell you, Ted, come to Canada, you can hang around with anybody you want to.
Oh,
no problem.
Yes. Good, good. The transhumanists are just enamored. Their highest value is intelligence. And if you're in computer science, then intelligence is your goal, to create an intelligent computer. What an achievement that would be. After about seven decades of computer science, we still don't have an intelligent computer, but transhumanists are hopeful. They never give up hope that tomorrow or the day after that, we're going to have an intelligent computer. Then, if we enhance that computer's intelligence, it eventually will begin to self-replicate. Not only that, it will re-enhance its own intelligence until finally, like watching an elevator go up a skyscraper, we're going to watch the intelligence go up and up and up, and we're going to be watching from right where we sit. We're not going with them. Eventually, these intelligences will create a new species much more intelligent than we are. But you might say, well, gee whiz, that's species self-sacrifice. Well, not exactly, because, and this is where it's similar to the UFO phenomenon, there will be byproducts for your and my benefit, such as everlasting life. Now, that's kind of a nice benefit, isn't it?
Not too bad. Yeah, as long as
not too bad.
Life and a healthy
right.
life. And
there are two ways in which transhumanists can help you or me to live forever. Ever. It's one is called radical life extension, and according to RLE, radical life extension, what we do is we advance medicine on the assumption that death is a disease. For the most part, medicine thinks that death is natural. But if we think of it as a disease, then we're going to get a cure for it. And then you'll simply be able to live, you know, for 1,000 years. And if you don't get run over by a bus, think of all the times you can go through the PTA, you know.
It's part of Ted, I have to add, is part of this scanning, if you will, taking a digital imprint of ourselves and implanting that into some kind of mechanism, machine, the internet, for example? something along those lines?
That comes next. As I said, there are two theories of everlasting life. The first one is RLE, or radical life extension. The other one is the one that you just mentioned. And again, we have to get out the assumption. The assumption is that your or my intelligence is an information pattern. And it is analogous to, in fact, it is identical with information patterns in computers. Ergo, if we could take the information pattern, which is your intelligence, copy it, and put it into a computer, like we do software into a computer, there you would be. Bingo. Your self-consciousness would be in the computer. And as long as we keep it plugged in, and as long as we keep it making backups, then you could live forever in this disembodied form. And this is a different theory than the first one, but you'll find both of them amongst transhumanists. But note the whopping assumptions in both cases. The first one is that death is a disease, and the second one is that intelligence can be copied, and that it looks a lot like software in computers. And the second one is a sort of disembodied, separate the soul from the body point of view, whereas the first one is really a fully embodied point of view. Two very different schemes, but both of them within the transhumanist mindset.
Do you believe that there is a soul?
I definitely believe that there is a soul. The definition is important as to whether or not your soul, that is to say the essence of who you are as Brent, whether or not that soul is naturally immortal. I will say no, it's not. It's coterminous with your physical existence. If you are going to live forever, it'll be due to an act of God. And I distinguish soul from spirit. Soul is your essence. Spirit is what we share with others, and if we share a spiritual relationship with God, then that is the ticket to eternal life. It's not found in the soul, and so as you can imagine, I'm a little bit skeptical, well, actually quite a bit skeptical about the cybernetic immortality view. I'm a little bit easier to imagine the radical life extension, even though most people in medicine that I know will not grant the assumption that death is a disease.
When we try, I'm going to try and tie this in with what we were talking about before with the pyramids, and I'm thinking the Tower of Babel. When we try to extend our lives in that way, do you think that there will be ramifications to prevent us from doing that, in much the same way that there was ramifications for those who built the Tower of Babel?
Well, if you mean that God would somehow or other get ticked off and try to spoil our plans, no, I don't think that. The Tower of Babel looks a lot like the myth of Prometheus in Greece, even though one's Hebrew and the other is Greek. But in both cases, when you and I as human beings try to storm the gates of heaven, heaven gets ticked off and takes away our ladder, so to speak. The transhumanists are boldly Promethean. They know that they are storming Mount Olympus, and they are not expecting Zeus and the other gods to punish them at all. The modern version of the Promethean myth is nature. Nobody believes in the gods of Olympus anymore, but we do believe that nature will clobber us, and you can see that at work in the Sierra Club and also in the genetics movement. As I mentioned, the title of my book that Francis Collins wrote the foreword for is called Playing God, and that means that the Promethean myth that's or rather, we're going to violate nature, and nature is going to strike back and clobber us. That myth is very much alive in the culture and in the scientific community. So the question is, should transhumanists be afraid of the Promethean myth or the Tower of Babel? Well, let me just say, they're not in the slightest intimidated by that. And frankly, I'm not afraid of it either.
Fair enough. Now, is there a fear that once we've created this hybrid between man and machine, if you will, that man will no longer be necessary? Is that part of the plan?
Actually, it really is part of the plan.
Put an expiration date on mankind.
Put an expiration date on the human race, and it's going to be over. Now, if I were a transhumanist, I'm not, but I kind of like going to transhumanist barbecues. if I were a transhumanist...
I bet you eat chips there.
Yes, that's pretty good. I like sense of humor, yeah. what I think if I were a transhumanist, I would say is, look, nature doesn't stand still. It's constantly evolving. And the human race is doomed anyway, just because evolution is going to surpass us. So why don't we try to take a hold of the reins of evolution and just guide it? And that will be our last gift, so to speak, to the evolutionary process. There is a sense in which the ultimate reality for the transhumanist is evolution, and you almost get the sense that evolution is mystical and that you and I should sacrifice our individualness on behalf of the betterment of evolution. And again, I think I see a kind of secularized spirituality poking its way through here, although it's not quite as obvious as it is in the UFO phenomenon, but it's still there for the transhumanists.
Do you feel that... Are you comfortable with that?
Well, first of all, the transhumanists that I know are all nice people. Nazism is something I'm really afraid of.
Here's my thing.
Go ahead. What do you think there, Brian?
Well, I'm thinking, if we start scanning our brains, if you will, or digitizing who we are, are we going to get ourselves in a position where we're going to say, well, geez, let's face it, Hitler wasn't the nicest of guys. Let's not digitize him. And then on down the line, it becomes a slippery slope on who gets digitized and who doesn't.
I think that is a very sound argument and concern, Brent, actually, that a technological triumph in one generation can become a weapon for another generation. And up until this point, this is not on the agenda of the transhumanists, but I genuinely think it ought to be. What I like about the transhumanists is that they do raise ethical issues, and here's an example. The first thing that transhumanists want to do is put implants in our brains that will enhance our memory. So you could have in your brain the entire Encyclopedia Britannica. And anytime you wanted to retrieve a fact, you just think about it, and there it is. Well, that's step one. Step two, you're going to want it updated, right?
Of course.
So you might as well have it tuned to a satellite, and the company in charge of the encyclopedia will simply send you new information whenever it's available, so you get daily updates right into your brain. Now, isn't that wonderful? Well, consider how terrifying this could be. The Nazis could get a hold of this, and they could put disinformation in your mind. Or, what is even more terrifying, what would give me nightmares, is that they put a Geico commercial in there. And you couldn't get away from advertising. And
talk about getting stuck with a song in your head.
Yeah. So there are scenarios, slippery slope scenarios, which we just have to run and see what kinds of bad things could happen here. That's not enough to stop the technological advance, but boy, we got to be cautious. I mean, the human race has proved itself quite capable of self-destruction in the past, and no reason to think the leopard is going to change its spots now.
Any idea, Ted, what type of time frame we're looking at? Are we looking at 1 year, 2 years, 100 years, 200 years?
Most transhumanists that I know like the year 2045. That's when Ray Kurzweil has prophesied that the singularity will take place. By the singularity, we mean that our subsequent generation of intelligence will take over, and the car will peel out and disappear in the distance, and you and I will be left in its exhaust.
Wow. You know, Ray Kurzweil, by the way, folks, same Ray Kurzweil that invented the Kurzweil synthesizer, and he had some of the best samples for musicians through the 80s and the 90s that were known to mankind. He's a real groundbreaker in terms of musical stuff, too, as well. Coming back to this, you know, what scares me, as soon as we said, well, we're planning an expiration date, we're planning an expiration date on the human race, I'm just wondering, as a theologian, what do you think God's going to have to say about that? He'll be, oh, yeah, well, sure, go ahead. You know, let the kids play with the matches a little bit longer till the house is almost burnt down. And
Well, I do have a high opinion of the human race. I think God does, too, because the incarnation took place in a human being. You know, a humble carpenter in Nazareth. So I'm not worried that God is going to stop caring for you and me in all of this. My affirmation of transhumanism is not that I want to see it achieve its goals. In fact, my forecast would be the assumptions are so flimsy that it's just not going to achieve its goals. But there could be byproducts. If they really treat death as a disease and push forward, hell-bent for election on nanotechnology and other forms of improving human health and well-being, we might not achieve everlasting life, but we could achieve better human health and well-being. And if that happens, I want to say, you know, thumbs up, go for it, you know. So the byproducts of transhumanism, I think, could be more valuable than the ultimate goals that it has laid out before itself.
Well, I'm just going to throw this out to you because it's night fright and we go anywhere, folks, as everybody knows on this show. Because God is eternal, is there a chance God could be a hybrid between machine and human?
No.
Good answer.
It's seldom that I give you a flat yes or no, right? I usually kind of waffle on the fence.
Okay, I just thought I'd throw it out there just to see how you would react to that.
I think there's such an enormous difference between being personal and being in a machine. And up until this point, we have no personal machines. We only find the quality of personality in organic beings. I mean, there's you and me and probably our pet dogs. And none of those are machines. And when we think of God as Trinity, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, one of the important things is that God is personal within the divine life, not a machine. So that doesn't mean there's anything wrong with machines. I just don't think there's anything divine in machines. So what raised that one, Brent? You were you had something on your mind.
Well, yeah, I was thinking of the Big Bang, you know, and
right.
And creationism. And you know, I studied Torah for a while here in Montreal at the Montreal Torah Center. And one of the things that one of the rabbis was talking about was the Big Bang. And if we look at a seed that falls from a tree, if you will, as the Big Bang. Well, everything that transcends from that seed, once it plants and takes root and it grows itself into a tree, as the Big Bang grew into the universe, and everything that falls off that tree and grows and creates the forest, everything is intrinsically connected back to that single seed. And that's the way I look at the universe. So if there are ETs out there, and between you and me, Ted, I pray to God we're not the smartest creations in the world. Because if we are, I mean, we're still shooting each other's butts off
after all.
And we know it's wrong, and we keep doing it anyways. And as I said in the first half of the show, we have the ability to feed everybody for the first time in the history of mankind, and we decide not to do it.
Right.
So I hope there's a species out there that has overcome these deficits, if you will, and I would like to call them brothers and sisters. That's the way I look at it.
Well, I have the same hope you do. My caution is only that scientifically, currently, this has not been demonstrated. But I still want to hope against hope, and the possibility of this being the case is scientifically plausible. So just because it's not been demonstrated doesn't mean that it's not true, and it could be true.
It could be true. Well, as you said with the chips, there are going to be good points. I mean, we've already seen this in animals. A friend of mine has three cats, and I said, I was watching the cats. I said, I'll be very careful. Be very careful. The cats don't get out. And she said, oh, don't worry. They're chipped. I said, what?
Oh, to be tracked.
Yeah.
Huh?
And oh my God. You know, and then, so the next
let's do that with our kids. Yeah.
Well, that's exactly the point that I was thinking.
Right.
My
right.
God, what parent wouldn't want that security that, God forbid, their kid should ever fall into some hands of a lunatic?
If there was a chip. Sounds good to me.
So, of course, you're going to agree to that, but what's the negative aspects of that? Then you're your big brother's watching 24/7.
Can you imagine the business that's going to crop up for every 13-year-old to come and have your chip removed surgically?
Good point.
You know, and get a tattoo and a nose ring while you're at it. Yeah.
So we have all these ethical questions that face us every day. Are there some, Ted, that you feel we've succeeded with and some perhaps we have not? And I'm going to go right to stem cells and embryos. We hear on one side the horrific stories where they're just having abortions left, right, and center for no other reason than birth control, instead of using birth control. And then we hear on the other side where they can take stem cells and rebuild whole nervous systems. There's ethical questions there. How do you feel we've fielded them so far?
I believe that with regard to stem cell research, we're better off now than we were 10 years ago in dealing with the moral controversy. I myself separate the abortion controversy from the stem cell controversy. And I regret, actually, about 1999, how the Vatican and some conservative Protestants kept trying to bring abortion and stem cells together. And they also tried, this is not widely known, they also tried to bring the feminists in to create this alliance.
Just educated me.
Yeah, and they thought, well, the feminists are going to want to join them. Well, the feminists did not join them, and so it was predominantly the Southern Baptist Convention and the Vatican that gave the moral arguments against stem cell research. And the big trump card they played is that the destruction of the blastocyst is the equivalent of murdering a human person. And, of course, none of us wants to be a baby killer, to be sure. It was my own judgment, and I'm not absolutely convinced of this, but it was my own judgment that blastocyst is not a human person in the same sense that you and I are. And the entire argument for the personhood of that blastocyst was based upon spurious science promulgated by the churches, namely that when an egg is fertilized by a sperm, you end up with a unique genome, and a unique genome receives a unique soul, especially created by God. It's actually called creationism. And therefore, the elimination of this unique genome is the same thing as killing a human person. And scientifically, this just didn't fly, first of all, because you can have all kinds of genetic combinations at fertilization, and then you've got cells splitting and dividing and coming back together, and you don't have an individual person until, in the mother's womb, it adheres to the uterine wall. That's the first time you get an individual person, physically speaking. And so what takes place on day 4 to 6 is not yet what takes place on day 12 or 14. So I took the position that doctors engaged, or medical researchers engaged in stem cell research, were not killing babies. If I could be shown to be wrong, I would change my mind. But that's been my position, and for the most part, over time, that's the position that most of the community has arrived at.
Okay. Nope. Fair enough, my friend. Fair enough. I think, you know, morally, I think, I don't think we have a right to tell a woman what she can and cannot do with her body. I just don't. I think it's preposterous to think that a man can come along and say, no, you can't do that. What right do we have? And that's the bottom line for me. Let's go somewhere else now. I'm going to go back to God. And if God
is waiting for you, so feel welcome.
I hope he can wait a lot longer than I have, than he has planned. Because I like your idea of an extended life, by the way.
Yeah.
If God is real, by extension, then, of course, is evil real? And if evil is real, can it be, does it come into existence through something we would call the devil?
Well, can I get technical? I wanted to say that evil does not exist.
Fair enough.
Yeah, evil is the power of non-existence. It's the power of non-being. Everything that God creates, everything that is by definition good. And one way to interpret what you and I experience as evil is that it tries to destroy what is good. So things that deteriorate and go from being into non-being are subject to the forces of evil. So in this way, I follow St. Augustine. For okay. St. Augustine, God is the ground of all being and the source of all good. So if you want to talk about a Satan or a devil, you have to talk about the opposite of that, which would be non-being. And non-being, when it clashes with what is, it creates what you and I experience as conflict, deterioration, and death. And that's where evil occurs. So you don't need to have the devil to be a person who is something, because if the devil is something, then he's good by definition. So I think that the devil is a symbol for the power of destruction or the power of non-being. So that's my vocabulary, and I don't know, was that the question you had in mind?
Basically, you know, I was going to come back to that Hitler thing again and the Nazis and how, in my mind, evil just stormed right across the world. And, you know, some people say without the darkness there cannot be light. You've heard that one before. And I always give the analogy because I have a lighting design degree from Concordia University in Montreal. And they taught me that if there's a fully lit stage, picture a rock stage with explosions going off and everything, and a single person walks out with a candle or a match, you certainly are not going to see that. however, take that same stage, engulf it in blackness, and that single person walks out with a match, that's going to be the brightest spot in the whole of the concert arena. So is that, is there a balance there, do you feel, between the darkness, evil, and goodness?
Nope.
No. Okay.
Nope, I can give you a flat one on that one.
Great.
Good and evil are not equal. Light and darkness are not equal.
Okay.
You can have light without darkness. You can have good without evil. You can never have evil without good, because evil is always a leech off the good. It's always a prostitution of the good. So you brought up Adolf Hitler. So suppose you were interviewing Adolf right now, and you say, Adolf, why do you do so much evil? He would say, I don't do any evil. No, no, no. What I do is good. What I do is I protect the German people from the reparations exacted on them by the evil allies of World War I. Or he would say, I believe in social Darwinism. I believe that we are going to help evolution to make a better human race, and the most intelligent and advanced members of the human species are the Aryans. Therefore, by eliminating people who are mentally handicapped, physically handicapped, gypsies, homosexuals, and on down the line, and then finally Jews, by eliminating these, we are going to purify the human race and help the human race to accelerate in its evolution. So Adolf would give you an appeal to the good for everything that he does. He would never say, I'm out to do evil. So what you and I feel when the bombs start falling is, my, Adolf is really doing something. He feels that it's good, but from here in my point of view. And so I think that in almost all cases, not all, but in almost all cases, what evil is a conflict with the prior good. There can be nothing that is purely evil.
Fair enough. That's really well answered. You mentioned Darwin, and again, once again, you must be clairvoyant, because one of the things I wanted to bring up, of course, is creationism. What's your stance on creationism and evolution?
First of all, on the grounds of scientific integrity, I'm going to embrace the original Darwinian theory of evolution through variation in inheritance and natural selection, and the neo-Darwinianism, wherein we fold genetic science into evolutionary science so that we can account for variation and inheritance acted on by natural selection. It's a good theory. It's good not because it's true. It's good because it produces research programs. You can't produce medicines in medical science unless you work with Darwin's theory of evolution. So it is productive of new knowledge. So I have to say, on strictly scientific grounds, we would be irrational if we do not embrace the theory of evolution. And I sometimes say, thank God for Darwin, you know. When it comes to the creationists, I think that the biblical creationists, such as Answers in Genesis on the website, I just find them leading us astray. They are full of self-contradictions, and they try to rally Christian belief against evolution. I just think it's a useless fight. The scientific creationists, however, I find very interesting. They're the ones who want to argue that the Darwinian theory is wrong on the basis of scientific evidence. I kind of like those people. I think their theory...
They have good barbecues too, Ted?
actually, I don't think they have as much joy as they should I suspect the Darwinists have better barbecues than the creationists do. Actually, I know because I've been to a few Darwinist barbecues. The best I did, I went out for lunch one time with Dr. Morris, the founder of Scientific Creationism, and Dwayne Gish. And I had a bunch of my graduate students around and one of my colleagues who's an evolutionary biologist. And Dwayne Gish was pronouncing with his Diet Coca-Cola in his hand, you know, what's worse than a godless evolutionist? And we said, no, what's worse? He said, a theistic evolutionist.
Oh, geez.
I said, well, why? Why is that worse? He says, because they look like they believe in God, but they're giving the farm away to the godless Darwinists. So I looked at my friend Marty and I said, what are we? And he says, I think we're a theistic evolutionist. So, at any rate, I find those people fun. They think scientifically, but again, you cannot consider the creationist position to be good science. It's bad science. But I do want to credit them with wanting to be scientific. It's just that they don't avail themselves of the best tools for being scientific.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think, Brent? Are you a creationist?
I'm both. I think ultimately.
You've got to satisfy those listeners out there. I should not have asked you that question.
No, it's fine. I believe in evolution, of course, but I think there was an ultimate game plan behind it all. I just don't think we're an accident. What is it? Einstein said God doesn't roll the dice with the universe or something along
those
lines. Yeah. I guess I kind of fall into that camp.
The better appeal would be Francis Collins there, who the language of God.
That's right. Yeah.
And Francis would hold the position that you just enunciated, namely that the evolutionary process was set up by God.
Yeah.
In the beginning, in order to bring the human race to where we are currently, and that God let nature run its course. And then he adds about Jesus Christ, well, that's a special intervention. But let me just say, here's a man who's a devout faith, mm-hmm. who also, he can't be a scientist without his Darwinism, you know.
That's it. Yeah, and I remember when I had him on the show, he couldn't just come on the show alone. He had to have somebody sitting beside him because he was in charge. Mr. Obama, President Obama, had put him in charge of the I can't remember the name of the National Institute of Medicine, I think, for the lack of better.
Yeah, the National Institutes of Health. He is now the director, yeah.
And he was not allowed to come alone on the show. He had to have a guide, if you will, beside him, who was very nice. But when I posed the question to Dr. Francis, depending on where the question was coming from, and perhaps what they thought my intent was, he had to run it by his guide before he could answer it, because I guess, you know, there's politics involved and stuff, and he has to be as unbiased as possible. So I respected that, and we got along great. And he's got this amazing, by the way, Ted, if you ever get to jam with him, I don't know if you play music or not, he's got a great, great custom-made guitar. Just to let you know.
I actually have heard him sing from that guitar, and I'm not a musician, but yeah, I've heard him. He's good, and he's a motorcycle rider. He's kind of a nice all-around guy.
Yeah, he's a sweetheart guy. Yeah. Hard to find a better man, that's for sure.
Right.
Okay, I'm going to go in a completely different direction again. Are you ready? Because it's Night Fright. What can we do? For God
Fright.
And country, let's talk about some Iranis. Rouhani, Obama, nukes, and Ahmadinejad, and where we came from with Rouhani. Are we better off or are we worse off? What do you think?
Well, I should mention that Huffington Post has just published two blogs. I shouldn't say blog posts by Leona Fox.
Okay.
And one is on D-Day and the other is on Flag Day, which is coming up. So your listeners could go find Leona Fox on Huffington Post. But the big theme there is Forgotten Country, and it's set up in the novel with that title, Forgotten Country, as a conflict. Leona's got two gods. One is the high god of Israel, and the other one is the United States of America. And she would prefer to worship and serve only the high god, but it's impossible. It's impossible because America demands so much. So she has this conscience problem, and she wrestles with it constantly. And you brought up Iran, and I'm a bit of a futurist, as you probably guessed. So Leona learns about the future of Iranian weaponry, and here's a secret benefit to reading this book. We can answer the question why Iran recently allowed international inspectors to come in and look at their uranium or enrichment program. Why? Well, the old-fashioned uranium enrichment centrifuges are big. They're easy to spot. And let's let the foreigners come in and look, because Iran has switched to a new technology. They now enrich uranium with lasers, which you can do in a garage. And so they've got the uranium enrichment program going on, but it's camouflage. The international inspectors aren't going to find it. And you learn all about this from Leona, the spy in Iran, when you read For God and Country.
Fair enough. That's great. Okay. On a personal note, do you feel that Rouhani is better than Ahmadinejad?
I actually don't have a personal opinion on that. Ahmadinejad was a known quantity, but the ruthlessness of the various regimes from 1979 down to the present time has not changed. And so I would hesitate making a visit to Iran, frankly.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, that's not going to happen in my future, that's for sure. Yeah, I've just done too many shows about the green movement from Iran, and I'm as close to the Canadian, Iranian, Persian community, I should say.
Oh, good, yeah, good.
As you can get. So it's just great. When I saw that on your website, I thought I'd just bring it up.
And
discuss it for a few minutes. Are we going to make it, Ted? Are we going to make it past, you know, the Ukraine? I looked at the Ukraine. A good friend of mine was Ted Sorensen, JFK's speechwriter.
Yeah, great.
I remember what he was telling me about the Cuban Missile Crisis and how close we were. Jacqueline Kennedy wanted to bring the kids home because she virtually thought everybody was going to die the next day, and so did the president. Are we going to make it past the Ukraine and everything else that's in our future?
I am not as worried about the Ukraine as you are, although it is the case, we know from experience, that any skirmish anywhere can get out of control and spiral up and become far more serious than when it began. Nevertheless, since 1945 in August, the dropping of those bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, we are at a crisis point virtually every day. Yes, we don't hear about it in the news, but the crisis point is there. And nuclear proliferation has not stopped, even though it's slowed. And every time there's a government change in a country such as India or Pakistan or wherever, I bite my nails because as soon as the new government gets in, they have control over nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. And anything can happen. We are not foredoomed to self-destruction, but we are not destined to spare ourselves from enormous consequences of this. Every day, I'm afraid human free will probably still is the thing we have to fear the most.
And it's funny you mentioned Pakistan, because yesterday, of course, we know that the Taliban stormed the an airport in Pakistan and killed all kinds of people.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, you know, as soon as they mentioned that, I thought, my God, if they can get away with that, what's to stop them from storming a nuclear facility?
I think you're right in having some trepidation with that thought.
Yeah, very much so. Do you believe in the power of prayer, Ted? I suspect you do.
I believe in the power of prayer. One of the problems is that God also has free will and may or may not respond the way we want God to.
So he doesn't always respond to numbers then?
That's right. That's right.
Okay. Does he hear the prayers of atheists?
Absolutely. And even when the atheists don't think they're praying. one of the good things about the atheists since 2006 is that they have tried to portray themselves as being more moral, more highly moral than the religious people whom they criticize. So if the atheists convince themselves that they have a responsibility to stay moral, I want to call that a blessing, actually.
Many people say religions have caused all the wars in the world, or the many more people have died over the name of God than anything else. How do you respond to them when they say something like that to you?
Well, I don't think I could use that word over the air, but it begins with a B and ends with a T. The religious traditions that exist currently are the reservoirs, if not the fountains of love and compassion and the search for peace and unity today. And believe it or not, even within Islam, if you poke around in Islam, you're going to find some really compassionate and intelligent and insightful Islamic theologians and leaders. So just to think that every Muslim is a terrorist is such a mistake. And yes, indeed, there's no question that you could read history in such a way that you've got all these religions fighting with one another. But a closer look will show that territorialism, tribalism, and in today's world, geopolitics, these are the causes of great violence. And it's not that religious traditions are innocent, to be sure, but political forces are always going to conscript otherwise noble religious traditions into their service so that they can build armies and keep the people pacified at home. So to think that somehow or other, if we were to get rid of religion, we'd suddenly have world peace, I just can't think of anything more naive than to say that.
You know, and I always draw the analogy you had mentioned, Islam and terrorism, and I tell people, I say, well, gee, you know, the KKK are pretty devout Christians.
Yes.
Do you really want to describe every Christian you know as a Ku Klux Klan member?
I think
the terrorists are terrorists. They're thugs,
yeah.
Folks.
Yeah, that's right.
They use Islam. They pervert Islam, and they use it to their own end, and not a very, very good end. What's next for you, my friend?
I've got some colleagues at the Center for Theology and the Natural Sciences who are working with me on a project we're calling Astrotheology. In fact, next week at the Library of Congress, I think they're having a debate on astrotheology. Scientist Stephen Dick and a theologian there on the question of the meaning and the potential impact of the discovery of extraterrestrial life. So this is a big project that we have here in Berkeley with hot and cold running faculty and doctoral students and stuff. And we're having a good time interpreting astrobiology and related space sciences and looking at the ethical issues of space research and space travel and things like that. So that's what keeps me off the streets and out of trouble.
That's good to hear. Now, I was watching a special last night where they were talking about a moon, I think it was around Saturn, if I'm not mistaken, that is showing spurts, geysers, if you will, of water. It was on a NASA special. And this is very exciting because we know where we find water, we can find the building blocks to life. Do you think there's a possibility that we're going to find life in our own backyard, if you will? And I'm not talking about Martians. You know, I'm talking about biological life.
I did not see the NASA special, but Titan is one of the moons of Saturn that we've been especially concerned about. Cassini actually dropped a parachuted probe, and on Titan it looks just like here. You got mountains and streams, and you got rivers and oceans and everything. One of the difficulties is that the predominant chemistry is methane. It's not the chemical composition we have of Earth. So I know there's one speculation. Could there be something other, a form of life other than what we recognize here? I think I divide space research into two categories. The first is the search for microbial life here in our solar system, and then exoplanets, where the only place we're going to find intelligent life if it's there.
Makes sense. Makes sense. Folks, we've been speaking with Ted Peters, www.nightfrightshow.com. His books, and I say that with glowing admiration as I look for that piece of paper with the name of his books on it. And what did you do with it, Brent? Here it is right here. I'm so happy to be organized. The book we've been primarily talking about tonight is his latest book, UFOs, God's Chariots with a Question Mark. And, of course, that you can find that book, as always, at the www.nightfrightshow.com website. Just click on tonight's guest book cover. Take you right to a spot where you can order it. Also, there was For God and Tria we talked about. There's the Francis Collins forward book, as I call it, Playing God. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to get Kelly, if you're listening, I'm going to get you to put up Francis Collins' interview that we did right next to Ted so people can reference that as well. Because he's a fantastic guy. He's just
he's a great guy.
Yeah. And is there another book? I missed another book, didn't I? We were talking about transhumanism.
There's lots of them there. If the people would like to go to my website, you can see a kind of list, and it's simple, tedstimelytake.com, tedstimelytake.com. And there's a bunch of them there, and most of them dealing with the interaction between science and religion.
There's that darn music again, so I'm going to have to go. See, it's automatically, you see, this is the hybrid situation I was talking about before where the machine takes over and becomes God.
You're ready for the future, Brent.
I have totally enjoyed this, my friend. Do not be a stranger.
I've enjoyed it as well. And invite me back, and we'll continue these important topics.
Thank you so much for joining us.